This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. Because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. That's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the good people at the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, please go to pnwa.org. Got another debut author, great guy, Joe Milan. He got a new book out, The All-American, and what an interesting guy. He had a very unusual story about how he came to writing, came to it late, but boy, when he came to it hard. And it was great talking to him about that. Very honest guy, very straight, very unpretentious, really had a lot of fun. Joe is an assistant professor of creative writing at Waldorf University, was the David T.K. Wong Creative Writing Fellow at the University of East Anglia in the UK, and a Black Mountain Institute and Barrick PhD Fellow of Creative Writing at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. He has served as a fiction editor at Witness and is an MFA graduate at the University at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. He's an American with Korean ancestry and taught in Korea for 9 years. His work has appeared in Broad Street, The Rumpus, Friction, The Flexible Persona, LA Review of Books, The Kyoto Journal, and more, and The All-American is his first novel, and here's our conversation. So glad I get to share it with you. Enjoy. All right. Well, it's good. We've got, anticipated debut novelist Joe Milan here. Joe, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I got a lot of rain today where I'm at, which is desperately needed because it's been boiling otherwise.
Joe's out in Iowa, which we don't always think of Iowa as a literary state, but it is. There's one particular reason for that. You teach writing out there, yeah?
I do. I teach at a small liberal arts college named Waldorf University, and I teach creative writing, and I also teach lit classes and, of course, English comp, like most of us.
You're grinding it out. Okay. Well, listen, but the reason we're talking is not because you're a professor of writing and literature at Waldorf College, but because you've got your first novel out, The All-American, and this has been out for a couple months now. Yep. Came out April 4th, yeah?
That's right.
So a lot of attention. For good reason. How are you feeling? It's been a couple months. How has the reality versus expectation worked out for you?
It's been surreal because more people answer my emails.
Yeah, I'll bet.
So like in the past, when I just wrote a few short stories that got published, like you would want to do a reading somewhere and you would say like, hey, would you be interested in doing a reading or doing something? And it would just be crickets. But now the book has gotten enough really good attention that people are responding, not always saying yes, but they'll respond, which is a nice change.
That is nice. Okay. So let's back up a little bit. You feel like somebody for whom writing has been always on the horizon, or if not a central part of your life. Is that fair? Or did you come to it like in college? I feel like you've been doing it for kind of ever.
No, I came to it after college, actually. So
what?
I'm one of the few. So what happened was I wanted to be a filmmaker. I went to a school without a film program because I was, 18 and not very bright. I did playwriting, and that was the closest that I could do to filmmaking.
Wow, that's right.
And so me and my buddies would shoot short films and do all that. And after I graduated, I had this idea for a full-length movie, and I just couldn't get myself to finish the script, and I couldn't get myself to make it good. I knew it wasn't very good because one of those things that you realize once you've read a lot is you develop taste. Who was it? Ira Glass. mentioned that, and that's really true. Like you when you develop your taste, you can start looking at your work and realizing like, okay, this is working, this isn't working. And
Right.
so I was living and teaching in South Korea, and my uncle sent me a copy of Creative Screenwriter, and I don't know if the magazine's still out, but he sent me this copy because it had this, someone wrote that an article saying that if you're struggling with your screenplay, what you should really do is write it as a novel, because it's way easier to write it as a novel and get it published as a novel. And
Well, oh my God. Okay. All right. Interesting.
then like once the novel's bought and the film rights sell, you can just go and say like, here's my script
That
of the
is the
novel.
most idiotic, convoluted. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to whoever wrote that, but that is the weirdest route to getting, but okay, fine. All right.
I think what it was is it worked for him,
Okay.
and
Yeah.
it won't work for 99% of every other writer. But
Right.
I was, again, I'm like 22.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like, okay, this is my way forward. And what happened was I started changing my screenplay into prose, and I started writing. I got off work like 8 o'clock at night or something like that, and I kept writing until the sun came up. And
Wow. Really?
it was just straight. I think I may have made some coffee or something, but it was the first time I'd ever done anything in my life where I could just keep going and just, I loved it. And then I looked at it, and again, I had done enough reading, not necessarily short stories and prose, but a lot of playwriting and screenwriting. And I was reading it, and I was like, this is shit. Like, I need to get, I love doing this and I want to get better at this. And then from that point on, I don't know, it was just like when you find your form. And for me, I found my form and I decided like this is what I devote myself to. And so ever since that's when I started really writing and then trying to get better at writing and also seeking out prose that I actually wanted to read because I hadn't read too many books that connected with me.
Yeah.
As a young guy,
So you weren't a reader
and
as a young fella?
no, I mean, I wanted to be because every once in a while I would find something interesting, like some piece of nonfiction, like historical fiction or whatever, and I'd read it and I'd be like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Right.
The first book I ever really loved was a samurai book called Musashi.
Okay. Was it written in
And
English or was it written?
it was originally written in Japanese and translated into English, but reading about a samurai. A guy, how does a guy become a samurai?
Yeah, right.
And I loved it. But when I went and talked to my English professors, they're like, hey, what should I be reading? And they would hand my English teachers, they would hand me like Amy Tan, which for, a 13, 14, 15-year-old guy who is into samurai,
What a oh God, this drives me crazy. Okay, they meant well. They meant well.
they
Okay,
meant
they
well.
meant well.
But I didn't, because of that, like it was much easier for me to find films that I connected with,
Of
but I didn't
course,
find
yeah.
books until I was grown. And then I started reading people that I absolutely loved.
Right.
And, the first time I actually understood that I liked short stories was when I read T.C. Boyle's Greasy Lake.
I'm about to
And
interview TC Boyle. That's so funny. That's coming up. I haven't.
hey, if when you do, please tell him that Greasy Lake changed my life.
I'm going to. I will. So it changed your life. So talk to me about that. So how old are you when you read it?
I read Greasy Lake. I must have been like 20, shortly after I started writing. So that'd been like 22, 23.
Okay, so you read it, and because I've had experience like that, it sounds pretentious, but it's not. But when I read The Love Song of Jail for Proof Rock by T.S. Eliot, that I was 17, but it changed the way I thought and wrote to some degree. It was really profound in that way. So, how did Greasy Lake change you?
What changed for me was it was the first time it Greasy Lakes, a short story where these guys who are high school friends meet up again the summer after their first year of college, and they don't have anything going on, and they're just going to go and hang out and drive around, cause a little bit of mischief, and ha ha hee
Right.
hee, like this, look how cool we are. And that was the first time I read about a scenario where I was like, that was me, that is
Oh,
me, like
right.
me and my friends piling into a car,
Yep.
argue for 30 minutes about where to go,
Yep.
end up at a lame party,
Yes.
because we couldn't get into the cool party, just,
God.
and it was that same vibe.
That's so funny. I'm easily a generation older than you, and that is exactly what I did when I was a young guy. That is exactly what I did in Providence, driving around. Yeah. What are we going to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do?
Yeah, and then they end up thinking that they're going to hassle one of their buddies who they think has got his girlfriend in the back of his car at Greasy Lake, this crappy pond that's been polluted and stuff, because it's one of those suburban rural kind of forgotten parks where all the kids know to go to smoke pot or whatever.
Right.
It turns out it's not their friend, and it's a very angry man who, beats him up, scatters him, and then it only gets worse from there. I don't want to spoil it.
That's interesting. So was the, because as when you're an artist, there's a lot of things so this is actually it's interesting as you mention all this, because I teach a lot. And one of the things I like to teach the students is that we all have an aesthetic, but we're learning about it and we're always trying to satisfy it. And we're always looking for it to identify what satisfies it and what doesn't. And sometimes it's in the content, and sometimes it's in presentation, and sometimes it's in both. So T.C. Boyle has a very particular voice, very distinct voice. Was it the voice or was it the content that really excited you the most, just the nature of the story?
I think it was a combination of both, because it was before I discovered grit lit or anything that was, hip. Like
grit lit? Right, I haven't even heard that term. What the hell? Have I missed it?
it's guys like Barry Hanna. This guy's like, I need to look at my books. I'm blanking on a name.
That's okay. I mean, I can picture what grit. I mean, it sort of speaks for itself in a way, but
yeah, like Dennis Johnson. That's not actually
Dennis
true.
Johnson, really.
Yeah. So what it is is it's. Grit lit isn't just like it's not the contents, but it's that idea. It's rougher than, let's say, like a Ray Carver type of thing, because Ray Carver was obsessed with, picking out all those adjectives and picking out all those adverbs, the American declarative sort of idea. But, when T.C. Boyle, he published that story, I think in like 78 or 79, he was right in that zone of, like, it was really early in his career, and yet the line sung. So like the way he was developing his voice that, much later, like when he comes out with Water Music, it's fully developed, because he's done an incredible amount of reading. And so he can switch voices very easily. But the other part of it was, I hadn't read about young guys doing what young guys do.
Yeah.
And I hadn't read about it as unapologetically as that, because it's not just like, oh, young guys being, boys will be boys, but it's that the guys are fulfilling motifs that they think they're supposed to be, but not really.
Yeah.
And that line is a really, really, really hard thing to do, because it's very easy to, overblow and, go the macho route. It's very hard to expose where a character is trying to do that, but in reality isn't.
Right.
And that's what Greasy Lake did for me, because I read that and I was like, all of these epiphanies that keep on occurring towards the end to the very last image in that story, which is absolutely spectacular. He manages to show so much that I had never read, where that young guys understand but are afraid to admit.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because I do think that we can take, there's some cliches around young manhood which are worth debunking. Anybody who's ever been a young man knows that you are a full person with all kinds of feelings, with may not get expressed, but they're all there, particularly if you're like you and me who had artistic aspirations. There's a lot roiling around in there. So good for you. And you certainly, speaking of which, you certainly go after all that in The All American. I'm not going to try and give the whole story away. It is I haven't thought of this word in so long, a Bildungsroman. Would you say it is one of those? It kind of is.
It's a Bildungsroman, or in English, we always just, it's the same thing, a coming of age story, maturation narrative. Right. Yeah. It was very deliberately I chose that, because the idea about the All American is, it actually came about when I used to teach a class called American Culture in South Korea. And
so you're teaching the South Koreans about American, essentially about like.
My class was titled, it was American Culture, like 225. And it was a course for freshmen and sophomores who, and it didn't matter what major they wanted to go into. It was one of those courses that everyone recommended because Americans are weird. And if you're ever going to do business with Americans,
what's weird about us? I don't understand. Okay.
And so it was my job to teach them about like, okay, American culture is like this, which is absolutely bananas. But
fun. I think it would have been fun to teach it in a way. You get to tell you got to tell them all. This is what America is. You got to be the little keyhole through which they peered at what America really was. Big responsibility, Joe.
Yeah, it's my fault. but the thing I actually relied on was there was this State Department academic, like back in the 80s, he wrote the 13 values Americans live by. His name was Robert Coles. And it was a primer for diplomats from other countries.
I see. Okay.
So you're going to go to America, you're going to do business, you're going to negotiate, whatever. Here's like 13 basics of American culture that should give you a little bit of insight of like why Americans are the way they are. Okay. And I would, so that matched perfectly a semester. Semesters are typically around 15, 16 weeks,
right?
13 values, a value a week. There we go. And one semester when I was teaching that class, a student, you know, rose their hand and asked, like, does anyone ever use all these values? Or was it like, is it always true? And, you know, I thought like, well, no, like everybody, we bend rules, we do things. But right. I started wondering like, what would happen if a character embodied all of these rules?
Just right.
Fully believed it. 100%
right.
USA. What would that look like? And that's where my character came from. And because he's trying to be as ultimately American as possible, a lot of the literature that we often gravitate to as our best is often the Bildungsroman. It's the coming of age story. So Ellison's Invisible Man, you look at Huckleberry Finn, like sure. a lot of this is always built off this idea. So that's why I chose this format.
Well, but it also mirrored your own life in that you really, your artistic life was quite the journey going from one thing to another, discovering what you wanted to be at such I guess I interviewed 1,000 writers and usually it's young, but obviously it doesn't have to be. But it's fascinating to me that this writer was living in you. I always wonder what's he doing? Because that writer has to be doing something, right? If you start writing and you go, oh, this is it, I'm home. Where was the outlet for that prior to that? I guess just, you know, reading, goofing around, smoking pot. I don't know. You know, besides you suffuse it, you just kind of like don't let it out. I don't know.
No, well, I think I used to just, I would hang out with my friends and retell our stories of our adventures like in high school.
Oh,
so, okay. You know, I was that guy.
You were the bard.
When I was in in college at the bar or whatever, I was the one who reaccounted whatever that was going on. I tried to make films and try to write short plays, but I guess the reason why it never really clicked for me, it wasn't just because I wasn't very good at it, because nobody is very good at it when you're getting started anyways, but it was the fact that I didn't enjoy the process because I always had that inkling that whatever I made would constantly be torn apart to a point where I wouldn't recognize it.
By somebody maybe that else.
Was, yeah. Right. So like, it's, like that's like collaboration works if you're actually working together to collaborate to make it happen. But like when you're sitting there and you're playwriting by yourself, for me at least, I felt that whatever great idea I had would get wouldn't I spend all this time trying to distill it and not distill it very well. And then I also don't have any faith that it's ever going to look anything like what it happened in my mind. Whereas I think the reason why I connected with writing prose was, this is telepathy, man. Like you have, every time you open up a book, a good one, you read a moment of someone else's thought.
Yeah.
Like that is spectacular. And that is something, it's magical, and you can go anywhere with it. And it's just, it's different than even storytelling.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's more intimate. And what's weirder still, Joe, is that people have read your book and each one of them has read a different book. Cause each one of them, you know, they all do. Cause I have, you know, I write stuff that is kind of inspirational, not kind of, that's what it is. And so when people contact me, they're always like, thank you, you know, and that's great. But whenever they talk about it, it's like, oh, that is, it always sounds different than the book I wrote, which is like, they do with it what, you know, they find the thing they need. But I suspect as you, I don't know, literary writers don't hear as much from their readers as I think they should, but they don't tend to. I don't know if you've heard much, but it always feels like they've read their own book. I don't know if that's been your experience. Yeah.
Definitely, like I've gotten some emails, and I think first it just blows my mind that anyone would bother tracking down my email to
you see
write 2-3 pages of not always praise. It's sometimes like, you know, you weren't right with this character because of blah blah blah. Yeah, like I wasn't even thinking of that, but yeah, I was really early on, the first time I actually met readers who weren't people I knew, and who weren't like from my publisher, W.W. Norton.
Right.
I had done this independent book conference for booksellers, and someone had tracked me down at the airport on the way out in order to talk to me about one of the characters.
Wow.
And she was talking to me about like, okay, here's my interpretation of this character. Is that right? And I had no idea like how to respond to that, because I was just getting ready to, I was trying to find my gate.
You were just being a normal person, and suddenly you were a celebrity, much to your own, in your own small way. And it's a weird thing, but what will happen is you will learn how to respond to those questions, probably, because you'll get them again and again in different, you know, you will learn the kind of questions you will get and how you will probably say, well, I remember Jan Martel, who wrote Life of Pi, and I was interviewing him about that. And he said, some woman came up to him and she said, I loved The Life of Pi, and I loved how you wrote a book about marriage. And he said, I did what? And she said, you wrote a book about marriage. She says, she said, I've been married, and that tiger is marriage. And he said, okay, then. Yes, it is. And I think that is, I believe in that relationship to the reader and their interpretations of it. Whatever you think it is, for you, that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I was actually going to ask you, like, because you're writing inspirational things, like, is it just different forms of inspiration, or is it like in the same vein that you were looking
always
for,
in the same vein? It's to creative people and write of people. It's sort of, I deal with the psychological and emotional challenges of creativity. I leave the craft to other people, but I think that the psychological hurdles around creativity, the emotional spirit are significant. And so that's what interests me. And so that's what I help them think differently about it. Because I think, you know, one way to think about it is, if you think I can't write this, you can't write it. But as soon as you start getting interested. And actually, what one interesting moment in your little journey that you described to us, which you sort of threw off jokingly, but I think it's a significant moment, was when you read your first, was it your first, I don't know if it was your first screenplay, or no, it was your first novel you were writing. And you looked at it and said, well, this is shit. And you, I got to get better. Now, for a lot of people, maybe you were not giving us a completely accurate, but for a lot of people, that is devastating to look at their own stuff and realize, oh God, this is awful. And they can't bring themselves to just learn how to make it better. But it sounds like, if you were being honest, while it was probably not a great moment, you didn't see it as proof that you had no talent or no ability. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, for me, I didn't start out Like I learned to read very late because I had a lot of like hearing difficulties as a little kid,
Oh,
and
okay.
that put me back. And so like reading and learning how to do things and like just learning how to do school, that took a really long time for me to figure out. Why that matters is that I really subscribe to the belief that you can always get better. Now,
I love it.
whether or not you get great, like that's so complicated and so much to do with things outside your control, it doesn't matter. So like for me, the reason why I could look at that first draft, and I'm being earnest about this, is that
Yeah.
when I went through that night and I'm looking out the window and realizing like I'm tired. Oh shit, I need to get to work. And I'm thinking, I've never experienced anything like that. And I decided like in that moment, it was just, when you're out there in the desert and you find a drink of water. And for me,
Yeah.
having that moment, I decided like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And
Right.
when you think about something like that in terms of like, this is the rest of my life, then I'm not writing one novel.
Right.
I'm writing for the rest of my life. And so, of course, a lot of these drafts, I don't know about other writers, but I know for me, the truth is that I have a lot of drafts of novels that didn't work out, and they're in a filing cabinet. I used to call the on my computer, I used to have a folder called the folder of abandoned children, because I always had hope that I would go back and rescue them. But every time I saw it, it made me feel way too guilty and way too traumatic. And so I changed it to like something innocuous like holding pan. But the fact was like once I made a decision like that, like this is what I'm gonna do. And I have no control whether or not it's gonna be successful or not, because the minute you realize, and I had this because shortly after that, I went back to Seattle where I went to college, and I was visiting some friends on my and I was just bumming around at the time after my first contract teaching. And I went to the old school library to the section of fiction, which I had never gone to in the 4 years that I'd been there. And I just saw it's the Suzzillo Library and in the University of Washington, and it's huge. And they have like 4 or 5 floors in the basement, and it's just books. And some of these books are dusty, and there's a lot of dust, and some of them aren't. And you look at this and you think, every one of these people has done the thing that I really want, and I have no idea who they are. And that's okay, because that suddenly takes all that. You start, it just starts occurring to you like a lot of this stuff is like, you can't have millions of books down there and say that, oh, only the ones that we teach in our literature classes are the great ones.
That's
No,
right.
there's plenty of amazing books that just didn't luck out. Like Moby Dick was a failure in Melville's life, and it was like 100 years later when it got like brought back into the American imagination, and now we talk about it as if it's like a foregone conclusion that it's a masterpiece. But no, and I mean that's
Great
all.
Gatsby the same way. Great Gatsby was not a thing.
I
It
didn't know that.
didn't do that well, no. I mean, Hemingway recognized it as great, and Fitzgerald loved it, but it actually didn't do that great. Not compared to his other stuff. Yeah.
Go figure.
Afterwards.
And yeah, and that's the thing we all talk about now is Gatsby.
One of the things I love about doing what I do is I only read books for people I'm going to talk to because they do it a lot. And up until I did started doing this in my 40s, I only read dead writers pretty much. I mean, pretty much like that's who I am. And so now I don't interview dead writers. And so it's a much more living, breathing view of literature and just books in general as a thing that's happening all the time. Because it from, in the classroom, it can start feeling a little dusty, a little staid, and like it's just this one thing. It's ever evolving. See, and now you're a part of it. Now you're a part of that new tradition, Joe. And so I assume you're working on book number two. I can't imagine you're not. Or maybe it's done. I don't know, man.
No, it's nasty, the
Oh.
process. I've written 3 complete drafts of it, and I've thrown them all away because
Brutal.
I it's just the process. It's the process this book needs. I'm really trying to race against my own doubts to just get a draft of it done that I'm happy with, because I keep on stopping because is not doing exactly what I think it should be doing in my head. And I think, you know, seeing one book through, finally seeing it published, it is helping me realize that, like, you just got to get to the end, then you have something to fix. I mean, that's the old,
you know,
truism.
thank you because I have told my clients I work with, I'm like a writing coach, and I don't often read their stuff, but I will talk to them about what they're going through, and I'm like, you got to finish. You don't know what you have until you've written the end of something, a draft. You have to get to the end because you really don't know what it is until you reach some kind of end. Oh, it's good to hear my wisdom validated by others. All right, Joe,
yep.
You're promising talent. We are eager to see where it will go. I am very happy for the success of this book. You seem like such a sweet guy.
Thank you.
I got one more question for you, though.
Sure.
I want you to think, even though you're relatively, you're such a young pup, you're relatively new to the writing game in the grand scheme of things, but clearly that doesn't matter. But I want you to think about the writing you've done, the novels you've abandoned and the novels you've finished and the short stories, even those screenplays and plays. And think about all that writing. And if it's taught you anything just about life, what's it taught you?
The thing it taught me is that the real problems you have can't be fixed. It has to change a mindset. Like you can't, problems can't, I mean, there's problems like, okay, I can't eat enough. I need to find more money in order to eat enough. And, but a lot of those big problems that plague my characters, the only way they can get out of it is if they change the way they think about themselves and the problem. Like, it's, nobody actually wants money. Really? Nobody gives a shit about dollars and cents. They give a shit about the feeling good, feeling like you accomplished, feeling like you did something.
Exactly.
And, you know, when it comes to most of our other problems, like the reason why I wanted to write about a young guy like this, who's so bullheaded and like so many of us, is that he doesn't even realize how bullheaded he is because he's trying to uphold ideas that can't be upheld. He thinks because if he does this, this will make him a successful American. And you can't be successful because it's, even if you got all that money, it won't give you the thing that you're looking for. You have to know that. That's a change of mindset. Then everything else can happen.
Man, you are speaking my language, brother. You are speaking my language. That's actually, in truth, you asked me what I do. That's actually what I do, is talk to people about their mindset. That with writing, it's mindset first, writing second, mindset first. It's all mindset. Oh, good. See, I knew I liked you. This is good, Joe. Congratulations on the book and good luck on the next one. I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, thank you.
All mindset. Yeah, it's all mindset. It's really true. That's been the focus of the work I've been doing about the mindset you have to be in. He wasn't talking about this. He was talking about what fiction taught him, but it's writing is a mindset. The frame of mind you have to be in to write is mindset. It's all mindset. Totally agree. I want to thank my producer, RJ Jeffries. Thank you, my friend, and all of you out there. I want to thank you. I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, go find something you love to do and do it.